I teach other children how to play safe. Kids shouldn't play near lawnmowers. Lawnmowers are very loud. The driver wouldn't be able to hear you if you were playing anywhere near. It's very important to be cautious.
Whatever game you play, play safe.
A message from the War Amps. Learn more at waramps.ca.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
Good morning, you're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. Hopefully you all are having a great day and a great weekend. Hopefully everyone surviving okay with COVID, considering there's been a rise in COVID cases in the city. We're now up to about 39 as of my recording, which is Sunday the 15th. And I hope everyone stays safe and try to stay home. Don't go out unless absolutely necessary, as many people are starting to say, and the better we keep track of it now, the less we'll have to worry about in the future. So please, stay safe out there. Cases are rising. With that being said, let's get on with today's topic. Today, I would like to talk about the history of computers and computing. Now, just a quick side note. Remember today my dad was mentioning something about the abacus, and I didn't have an idea for the show, so I was thinking, what's a good idea? And computers was in my head, and I'm like, okay, that's a good idea. I came up with it myself, but I'll give credit where credit is due. I think he planted the seed about the abacus into my head, and that may be where that came from. So there, Dad, hope you're happy. Now, next, I'd like to start with just a little bit of history of computing itself. Now, considering that there's not a super long amount of history in computers, I might get into a little bit more nitty-gritty, just to get a little interesting and talk a little bit more about maybe things people may not know about. So without further ado, let's get started. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the abacus, as really, some places may not have it, but the abacus is really kind of an old, really old computer. Now, the abacus is a Latin word, which has its origins in Greek, which was what? Abax or abacon, meaning table or tablet, which in turn probably originated from the Semitic word meaning sand. The abacus is one of many types of counting devices which were used to count large numbers. Now, it exists because, I mean, well, we all know that counting is kind of tough without numbers. But there was a time when writing numbers didn't exist. The earliest counting devices were, of course, your human fingers on the hand, and we were capable of counting up to about 10 things. Toes were also used to count in tropical cultures. Then, as even larger quantities, greater than the fingers could represent, were counted, many natural items like pebbles, seashells, and twigs were used to help count. Merchants who traded goods needed a way to keep count, inventory of the goods they bought and sold, and various portable counting devices were invented to keep tallies. The abacus is one of them. and it was invented to help keep count of large numbers. And when the Hindu-Arabic number system came into use, abacai were adopted to use place value counting. Abacai evolved into electromechanical calculators, pocket slide rules, electronic calculators, and now abstract representations of calculators or simulations on smartphones. Now, again, they're more of a calculator than a computer, but like most stories of computing, a lot of it stems from crunching numbers and doing mathematics. And I mean, nowadays, it's anything from mathematics, economics, chemistry, physics, computer science. Nowadays, computer is used for everything, as we all know. I mean, without computers, who knows, maybe we wouldn't even be listening to this today. But abacai were one of the original counting devices. Now, there's also things like counting boards and things of that nature. And I've heard even, you know, stories of possibly sticks with, you know, tally marks on them. But that is just kind of how counting was done. Now, of course, many different devices existed, the abacus being, well, the most famous. And I mean, there's many different types of counting devices and boards, abacai. I mean, there's many different kinds, but I don't think that's the important part here. I think the important part is to look at, well, computers. Now, one quick thing to mention is that abacuses are still used today by shopkeepers in Asia and Chinatowns in North America. It's still taught in Asian schools and a few schools in the West. Blind children are used to use the abacus, where their sighted counterparts would be taught to use paper and pencil to perform calculations. And one particular use for the abacus is teaching children simple mathematics, especially multiplication, as it is an excellent substitute for rote memorization of multiplication tables, a particularly detestable task for young people, as I'm sure we all know. It is an excellent tool for teaching other base numbering systems, since it also easily adapts itself to any base. Now, a lot of it is out of date now, and I mean, an abacus is not really that common, as we all know. But it's continued to evolve into the modern slide rule. The last mechanical evolution of a portable calculating device was before the electronic era brought the digital calculator. In 1972, the Hewlett-Packard HP35 scientific calculator made the slide rule obsolete. And of course, a few decades later, scientific calculators evolved into programmable calculators able to display graphs and images on bitmap LCD screens. And during the brief period when they rose to popularity, a hybrid abacus digital calculator was manufactured to help abacus users in the transition. In the 21st century, counting devices that are portable rarely exist as separate things. Instead, they're simulated using apps or on a desktop computer, smartphone, or tablet. Many civilizations which began recording history with a stylus and a clay tablet thousands of years ago is reusing those original terms today. Now, slide rules, if nobody knows what those are, it's kind of like a ruler, but it has a middle part that slides around. Now, an example for those who don't know what they are, I used one once when I was in Sea Cadets and I was on the boat. And you know, you might not have had a calculator around, and you wanted to calculate, you know, if I'm going this distance and this speed, how much time would it take? And you would set your slide rule to the speed and the distance, and it would tell you the time it takes to get there. And basically, it's just a simplified version of an abacus. But of course, nowadays, even then, we probably could have used phones. But I mean, nowadays, if I need to know something like count something, I'll just open up my phone and I'll add a bunch of numbers to a calculator. For example, I worked the other day, they were doing inventory, and one of the guys said, you know, it's a tedious task of counting it all. So he opened up the calculator on his phone and just kept adding each number he counted. So if he counted 70 of this and 100 of that, he'd add 70 plus 100 plus whatever the next number is, because it's so much easier, especially with large numbers, to count on a phone that within 2 seconds will give you an answer. Now, that is talking about the abacus, and I think we need to move on. However, I think an abacus plays an important role in kind of the start of computing. Now, I got a little bit of my history from the Ryerson website on the abacus, but the next, a lot of it comes from Live Science. The history of computing is not born out of entertainment or email, of course, which didn't exist until not that long ago, but it was out of the need to solve a serious number-crunching crisis. During the 1880s, the U.S. population had grown so large that it took more than 7 years to tabulate the U.S. census results. The government sought a faster way to get the job done, and that gave rise to the punch card-based computers that took up entire rooms. Here's a common, I guess you could say, it's a common, well, term people always say, and a common phrase, that the smartphone in your pocket has more computing power than the computer that sent the man to the moon. Now, it all starts back in, well, 1801 in France, where Joseph-Marie Jacquard invented a loom that used punched wooden cards to automatically weave fabric designs. Early computers would use similar punch cards. In 1822, an English mathematician, Charles Babbage, conceives of a steam-driven calculating machine that would be able to compute tables of numbers. The project, funded by the English government, would be a failure. More than a century later, however, the world's first computer was actually built. Many people don't realize this, and I didn't know this till semi-recently when I actually first saw it, and I believe it was a picture and a little blurt in a documentary or something about the machine. That I believe it was the Charles Babbage machine, about computers and how computing, actual computers, date back to the 1800s as counting devices, which again stem from the abacus. In 1890, Hermann Holyoath designed a punch card system to calculate the 1880 census, accomplishing the task in just 3 years and saving the government $5 million. He established a company that would ultimately become IBM. Now, a bunch of time later in 1936, comes the story of Alan Turing. Now, who is he? He was kind of the godfather of computing, and he's regarded as kind of one of the most important people in all of, well, the history of the computer. I'd like to talk about him a little later, but in physics and chemistry, you have the Nobel Prize. In computing, for computer science and things of the like, you have, well, the Turing Award, Turing something. The award, the greatest award you can get in computing, is named after Alan Turing, the first creator of the computer. Now, he is very important. There's even a nice documentary on him called The Imitation Game. Alan Turing presented the notion of a universal machine, later called a Turing machine, capable of computing anything that is computable. To this day, there are many paradoxes and even names of, you know, if a computer can outsmart a machine. Sorry, if a computer can outsmart a human and make a human think that it's not a computer and it's a real person, it passes the Turing test. And something that passes the Turing test is the ultimate goal. And Alan Turing proposed this in the 1930s. Even to this day, there's things about things that aren't computable. And can it pass the Turing test? Can it beat a human at knowing if something's a human? And this is what all modern computing was based on. It was all based off of his idea. Alan Turing is probably one of the most important figures in all of modern computers. In 1937, J.V. Atanasoff, a professor of physics and mathematics at Iowa State University, attempted to build a first computer without gears, cams, belts, or shafts. In 1939, Hewlett-Packard is founded by David Packard and Bill Hewlett in a Palo Alto, California garage. This is according to the Computer History Museum. Now, this isn't really a trivia question, but can you guess what kind of computer I'm recording this on? That's right, it's an HP. HP is Hewlett-Packard, and it still exists today. Just like a lot of other companies like IBM. 1941, Atanasoff and his graduate student, Clifford Berry, design a computer that can solve 29 equations simultaneously. It marks the first time a computer is able to store information on its main memory. That doesn't sound like very much today, considering our computers can store terabytes of data and compute billions to trillions of things a second. But back then, that was astronomical. Just a quick reminder that you're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. Now, I think we should take a quick break and talk a little bit, have a nice little song that involves computing. So stay tuned for the song here on CILU 102.7 FM. This next song I'm going to play isn't exactly about computing, but it kind of is something that I feel is good for people to hear. I think it'll be an important song, as it talks about how it's a song about when all modern conveniences disappear and trying to live with that. And it's a man living in a modern world where they disappear. And it's I think it's pretty interesting, as it tells the story of, you know, what could happen if it disappears. And I feel for those of us who may live in today, I mean, imagine not having a phone, a computer, not being able to check your emails, call a friend. I think it's an important, I think a song could provide a lot of meaning to, you know, what everyday life is like in the modern day and how much we rely on things. But without further ado, here is Nothing But Flowers by Talking Heads on CILU 102.7 FM. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. That was the Talking Heads with Nothing But Flowers. Before the song, we were talking about computing. Now, that song kind of talked about how, you know, if everything disappeared, how would we survive? And I think it's good because, I mean, not trying to be down or anything, but it is kind of something people worry about is what could happen if we become too reliant on computers. Anyway, let's keep going with our talk on computing. In 1943 to 44, two University of Pennsylvania professors, John Mulcley and J. Presper Eckert, built the electronic numerical integrator and calculator, ENIAC, considered the grandfather of digital computers. It fills a 20-foot by 40-foot room and has 18,000 vacuum tubes. In 1946, Mulcley and Presper left the University of Pennsylvania and received funding from the Census Bureau to build the UNIVAC, the first commercial computer for business and government applications. In 1947, William Shockley, John Bardeen, and Walton Brattain of Bell Laboratories invent the transistor. They discovered how to make an electric switch with solid materials and no need for a vacuum. Transistors are extremely important. All modern computers use transistors. And without transistors, well, you wouldn't be able to do much. Almost any electronic device you use today, even the wall plugs for your computer, your phone, anything that your phone, your computer, any kind of audio equipment, your television, even an electric piano, electric instrument, temperature sensors, furnaces, air conditioners, fridges and stoves, they all probably have a transistor in there somewhere. Transistors kind of build all computers, and there's multiple different kinds, but for simplicity's sake, I'll just mention that there's PNP and NPN transistors, which are bijunction transistors. There's also the field effect transistors, or FETs. Now, these transistors have lots of quirks to them. And, I mean, I talk about them in my electronics course, but if you're interested, there's probably some videos on YouTube explaining them. But these transistors build the modern world, and it revolutionized computing. In 1953, Grace Hopper develops the first computer language, which eventually becomes known as COBOL. Thomas Johnson Watson Jr., son of IBM CEO Thomas Johnson Watson Sr., conceives the IBM 701 EDPM to help the United Nations keep tabs on Korea during the war. In 1954, which programming language is developed by a team of programmers at IBM, led by John Backus, according to the University of Michigan? It's actually the Fortran programming language, an acronym for Formula Translation. It's an older programming language that isn't common nowadays, however, is still used in some applications, especially in math and science, as it has benefits as opposed to some of the newer languages. That about does it for the first half of the show. So stay tuned in the second half, where we'll finish talking about some of the history and maybe get into a little bit about how computers work and possibly about Alan Turing himself. So stay tuned here on CILU 102.7 FM.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship, an inclusive spiritual community promoting a compassionate, just, and sustainable world. Find them online at luf.ca, on Facebook, or at 129 South Algoma, Sundays at 10:30 a.m. Live from the Rock Folk Festival, bringing the spirit of folk and folk music to Red Rock every August. Keep up to date with upcoming happenings and buy tickets online at livefromtherockfolkfestival.com. The Outpost, Lakehead University's pub, full-service restaurant, and live music venue. Find them on Facebook to stay up to date on all the happenings during the school year, like Tanker Tuesdays and Pub Night Thursdays.
Welcome back. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. If you're just joining us, I thank you. And if you're coming back from the first half of the show, welcome back. We've been talking about computers, and we ended by talking in 1954 about the Fortran programming language, which is about 68 to 69 years ago now, depending at what point of the year it was created. But it's quite old in all seriousness, and it's amazing that it still exists in some capacity. The next is in 1958. Jack Kilby and Robert Noyce unveiled the integrated circuit, known as the computer chip. Kilby was awarded what for physics in 2000 for his work. 2000, he was awarded a Nobel Prize in Physics for his work. This is a monumental occasion. The integrated circuit, or an IC as some people refer it, as it's sometimes referred to in literature, and probably people out there refer to it as that as well, is basically a chip that has transistors kind of programmed in a certain way, and a little chip that's smaller than if you were to have those transistors all connected to themselves by hand. And I mean, an integrated circuit, an example would be almost like the CPU in your computer, which is maybe 1 inch by 1 inch or 1.5 inches by 1.5 inches, that have billions to trillions of transistors on them that run all modern devices. And considering that these integrated circuits back in 1958 may have been a few hundred to a few thousand transistors, it's crazy to think how powerful our computers have become. However, some integrated circuits are still used for things like transistor radios or sometimes small devices. Things like Arduinos or other small control systems may use them because they still have use. And as much as they may be built off of things from 40, 50 years ago, they're still useful as they're small and produce lots of computing power. If you don't need too much computing power, it's perfect. Next is that in 1964, Douglas Engelbart showed a prototype of the modern computer with a mouse and a graphical user interface, or GUI, G-U-I. It marks the evolution of the computer from a specialized machine for scientists and mathematicians to technology that's more accessible to the general public. In 1969, a group of developers at Bell Labs produced what? An operating system that addresses compatibility issues. Written in the C programming language, it was portable across multiple platforms and became the operating system of choice among mainframes and large companies and government entities. Due to the slow nature of the system, it never quite gained traction among home PC users. However, it does exist, and it is still used widely today in these kind of applications. It is the Unix language, a common distribution or distro, which is just a version of it, is Linux. Linux is part of the Unix system. Linux, Ubuntu, is a lot of different ones. Solaris, I believe, is all kind of Unix-based systems. The next is in 1970, a new form of chip was released. The newly formed Intel unveils the Intel 1103, the first dynamic access memory chip. Intel is still common today and is very common in most computers. And if you check your computer, I have an AMD myself, but lots of computers, you just check it, they might have that sticker saying Intel on them. And Intel is part of the name of the two founders, I believe, who founded the companies. And I believe one of the laws that every few years computing power will double was partly theorized by the guy who created Intel. And Intel as a company is massive. But it's founded by Gordon Moore and Robert Noyce. Now, Moore is very famous. Gordon Moore is very famous for Moore's Law, which addresses the computing power. And he's still alive. Now, Moore's Law is the observation that the number of transistors in a dense integrated circuit doubles about every 2 years. And Moore's Law is an observation and projection of a historical trend, rather than a law and or an empirical relationship linked to gains from experience in production. Now, he's the co-founder of Fairchild Semiconductors and CEO and co-founder of Intel. who in 1965 proposed that a doubling every year in the number of components per integrated circuit, and projected this rate growth would continue for at least another decade. In 1975, looking forward to the next decade, he revised the forecast that the growth would continue for at least another decade. He revised the forecast to doubling every 2 years at a compound annual growth of 40%. Now, it has been used in the semiconductor industry to guide long-term planning and to set targets for research and development, and the functioning a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Advancements in digital electronics, such as reduction in quality-adjusted microprocessor prices, increases in things like memory, like RAM and flash, and improvements in sensors, and even the numbers and size of pixels in digital cameras, are very strongly linked to Moore's Law. Now, industry experts have not reached a consensus on when they believe Moore's Law will cease to apply. Many microprocessor architects report that semiconductor advancement has slowed industry-wide since around 2010, below the pace predicted by Moore's Law. However, as of 2018, leading semiconductor manufacturers have developed IC fabrication processes in mass production, which are claimed to keep pace with Moore's Law. Now, one reason that Moore's Law may start to be wavering is, well, one of the main problems is because the smaller you get, the more and more a certain quantum effect will come into effect. And one thing that happens is the smaller and smaller and smaller you get, the more something called quantum tunneling can affect the transistor. As I mentioned before, transistors are like a switch, on or off, and computers work on ones and zeros, and on a one for on and a zero for off. Now, the big problem with this getting smaller is that once you reach a certain threshold, the electrons that travel through those wires have enough energy to push through that barrier and tunnel through it. It's like if you had a wall and someone was able to, you know, maybe they'll shrink in size, but they'll still make it through that wall. Now, the problem is at a certain value, these can actually cause problems where instead of a zero, you're getting a one, even though it's off. And these quantum tunneling effects can't really be helped. And it's been a problem. And slowly they're working past them, but that's one of the reasons why, is we're getting so small that it's getting almost impossible to continue getting smaller. And it's pretty interesting how Intel still is making them, so is AMD, and getting smaller and smaller even when it's getting hard to get smaller. Now, I can't really find where the name of Intel comes from, but I believe there is a bit of a story behind it. It's one that we all know, but many people don't know where it comes from. It was founded by pioneers Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore, who left Fairchild Semiconductors. Originally called NM Electronics for Noyce and Moore, the company purchased the right to use the name Intel, shorthand for Integrated Electronics, from a company called Intelco. That's where the name comes from. So originally, it was NM Electronics for Noyce and Moore, but it was shortened to Intel for Integrated Electronics, which comes from, I'm guessing, integrated circuit, which does make sense. Now, let's move on to 1970s and go to 1971, where Alan Shugart leads a team of IBM engineers to invent the floppy disk, allowing data to be shared among computers. Many people, especially younger listeners, may have never even heard of a floppy disk. And I know I sure barely remember them, and I might have only seen them a few times or used them a few times. As when I was very young, we had got our first... I think we had a computer in 2003 was when my parents 2003 2004 my parents first got a computer. I was about 3 or 4 at that time, so I vaguely remember a few floppy disks, but even back then it was still DVDs, which are slowly becoming a thing of the past. Floppy disks were kind of the first version of, well, your DVD or your CD, and it was how most things in computers ran. It was kind of a storage for anything and everything. In 1973, Robert Metcalf, a member of the research staff for Xerox, developed an Ethernet for connecting multiple computers and other hardware. Now, Ethernet still exists, as now we have Cat5e and Cat6 cables, and they kind of power our whole digital world. And even them now, even though they've existed for years, Ethernet's now slowly being replaced with optical fibers, which we may talk about in another episode. From 1974 to 77, a number of personal computers hit the market, including the Shelby and Mark 8 Altair, IBM 5100, Radio Shack's TRS-80, affectionately known as Trash-80, and the Commodore PET. In 1975, the January issue of Popular Electronics magazine features the Altair 8080, described as the world's first mini-computer kit to rival commercial models. And two computer geeks, Paul Allen and Bill Gates, offered to write software for Altair using the new BASIC language. On April 4th, After the success of the first Endeavour, the two childhood friends formed their own software company known as What. They formed the company Microsoft, which I'm sure, at least I know, again, I'm doing all this on my Windows computer, and I'm sure most people use a Microsoft at home, at the office, at school. One of those places I'm sure people use it. The next is actually, well, another tech giant, founded in 1976 by a man named Steve Jobs and also Steve Wozniak, who started on April Fool's Day and roll out What? The first computer with a single circuit board, according to Stanford University. They started Apple Computers and rolled out the Apple One. And for those who said they don't use a Microsoft system, and for those few people that might use Unix, probably use an Apple system. Or you might know Apple for their iOS system, which you use on your phone. Either way, that was founded back in the 70s. And the history of computing really starts to take off in the 1970s and 80s. Where modern computers really start hitting the homes. And of course, well, nowadays we all know how important computing is. Anyhow, in 1977, Radio Shack's initial production run of the TRS-80 was just 3,000. It sold like crazy. For the first time, non-geeks could write programs and make a computer do what they wished. 1977, Jobs and Wozniak incorporate Apple and show the Apple II at the first West Coast Computer Fair. It offers color graphics and incorporates an audio cassette drive for storage. In 1978, accountants rejoice at the introduction of VisiCalc, the first computerized spreadsheet program. In 79, word processing becomes a reality as MicroPro International releases WordStar. The defining change was to add margins and word wrap, said the creator Rob Barnley to an email to Mike Petrie in 2000. Additional changes included getting rid of command mode and adding a print function. I was the technical brains. I figured out how to do it and did it and documented it. In 1981, the first IBM computer, codenamed Acorn, was introduced. It used Microsoft's MS-DOS operating system, had an Intel chip, two floppy disks, and an operational color monitor, or sorry, an optional color monitor. Sears and Roebuck and Computerland sold the machine, making the first time a computer is available through outside distributors. It also popularized the term PC, or personal computer. It's kind of funny how personal computer was more of a name than just a blanket term, but nowadays, PC, computer, they're both interchangeable. In 1983, Apple's Lisa is the first personal computer with a GUI. It also features drop-down menus and icons. It flopped, but eventually evolved into the Macintosh. The Gavilion SC is the first portable computer with the familiar flip form factor and the first to be marketed as a laptop. In 1985, Microsoft announces what? According to Encyclopedia Britannica, it was the company's response to Apple's GUI. Commodore unveils the Amiga 1000, which features advanced audio and video capabilities. 1985, Microsoft announced Windows, which is the common Microsoft operating system that you see everyone use, which is nowadays is Windows 10. In 1985, the first .com domain name is registered. On which date? On March 15th. Years before the World Wide Web would mark the formal beginning of internet history. The Symbolics Computer Company, a small Massachusetts computer manufacturer, registers Symbolics.com. More than two years later, only 100 .coms had been registered. In 1986, Compaq brought the DeskPro 386 to market. Its 32-bit architecture provided a speed comparable to mainframes. In 1990, Tim Berners-Lee, a researcher at CERN, the high-energy physics laboratory in Geneva, develops hypertext markup language, HTML, giving rise to the World Wide Web. This is important, as in 1990, the start of this is the rise of the internet. We're changing just from computers being, you know, play games, do basic word processing, and changing to looking stuff up and having everything at your fingertips. Imagine me having to write my shows and find all my info at a library and spend hours trying to research it, where now I just click a button, type something in, and get an answer. In 1993, the Pentium microprocessor advanced the use of graphics and music on PCs. 1994, PCs became gaming machines as Command & Conquer, Alone in the Dark 2, Theme Park, Magic Carpet, Descent, and Little Big Adventure are some of the first games to hit the market. 1996 is also a very important year, as in this year, which company is formed that everyone knows about nowadays? Well, Sergey Brin and Larry Page developed the Google search engine at Stanford University. 1997, Microsoft invests $150 million in Apple, which was struggling at the time, ending Apple's court case against Microsoft, in which it alleged that Microsoft copied the look and feel of its operating system. In 1999, the term Wi-Fi becomes part of the computing language, and users begin connecting to the internet without wires. 2001, Apple unveiled the Mac OS X operating system, which provided protected memory architecture and preemptive multitasking, among other benefits. Not to be outdone, Microsoft rolled out XP, which had a significantly redesigned GUI. Windows XP became one of the greatest and is still one of the most beloved operating systems. It's the operating system I remember using before I used a bit of Windows 7 and then upgraded to Windows 10. Can still remember the early 2010s, Windows XP was very common. And even today, there's still some machines that use this almost 20-year-old operating system. And as great, as amazing as it is. In 2003, the first 64-bit processor, AMD's Athlon 64, becomes available to the consumer market. Most computers at the time were 32-bit. Now, I don't know if there's any truth to this story, but I've heard that AMD had to share the proprietary 64-bit with Intel to prevent antitrust legislation against them. But that is just a story I heard and is likely not the full story. However, AMD is one of the big players in the game, and recently they have been actually beating Intel. As I remember when I was a kid hearing about them, and they weren't that significant and haven't been for a while. But recently, a year or two ago, they launched their Ryzen series, which again, my computer actually runs off of AMD graphics card and an AMD processor. But that is the other thing your computer might have in it. And they've been beating Intel at, well, computers with their CPUs. 2004, Mozilla Firefox 1 challenges Microsoft's Internet Explorer, the dominant web browser, as well as a social networking site launches, which is what? Facebook. The next year, a video sharing service is founded, and Google acquires what company, which is a Linux-based mobile phone operating system. 2005, YouTube starts and is founded, and that same year, Google acquires Android, which is a Linux-based mobile phone operating system. 2006, Apple introduces what? Which is the first Intel-based dual-core mobile computer, as well as an Intel-based what? Nintendo's game console hits the market, which is what? 2006, Apple introduced the MacBook Pro. It also introduced the iMac. And Nintendo's Wii hit the market. 2007, Apple brings out something that brings computer functions to your pockets. 2007, the iPhone is launched and kind of changes it from just the computing world to now the smartphone world. And this is where we go from computers in the 1960s that were the size of a room down to the size of something that fits in your pocket or smaller. And it's always been amazing to me how amazingly fast things can be. There's a story recently that I read. As a physics student, sometimes I like looking up physics news. And an interesting thing I read recently in physics was that a problem that they have not been able to solve for years, which is the three-body problem, which involves three planetary systems which are revolving around each other. It's just kind of like a three-body system that are all kind of interconnected. No one could solve it. No one could solve it by hand either. But recently, they put it into a supercomputer, one of the world's strongest and most powerful supercomputers. And this problem that they haven't been able to solve for years, the supercomputer solved it in a matter of minutes. Just goes to show how powerful things are. Now, we didn't get all the way up to where I wanted to, but most of the newest stuff I'm sure most people understand and know. As, well, most people know that what's happened recently. I shouldn't have to go through that much. But quickly before I finish, I would like to mention that there is some powerful computers out there. Mainframes still exist, but not in the way we'd think. We now have things called servers, which are like kind of like a mainframe. They run all the Googles, all the Google servers, which run all, you know, if you look something up on Google, it's likely there. If you want to play a game that has other people, like a multiplayer game, uses servers. And that's kind of how everything manages to stay connected. And there's also supercomputers, which are rows and rows and rows of, well, big computers. Now, the world's most powerful supercomputer is, since June 2020, the Japanese Fugaku, reaching 415.53 petaflops, where one flop is a floating point operation per second. Now, a petaflop is equal to 1,000 teraflops, or 1 quintillion flops, and are rarely used to measure a single computer's performance, since they're only the fastest supercomputers run at more than one petaflop. Now, a petaflop is absolutely massive. A petaflop, one flop is a floating point operation, which is, as it says, you know, any kind of operation on a computer, like multiplication, addition, subtraction, division, and it has a floating point, so a decimal. And it can do 415.53 petaflops. And that's over a trillion flops. And it does that every single second. Just think of how large that is. It's kind of like a measuring instructions per second. But just think of a computer able to do that many calculations every single second. Thought that's a good place to end off the show. Seeing how original computers could barely do simple calculations in, you know, minutes it could take. And now we have computers that can do what millions of computers can do in seconds. It's absurd. Thank you for tuning in this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you all next week. I've been Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial here on CILU 102.7 FM.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
CIOU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
The Thunder Bay Country Market, keeping it local every Saturday from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. and every Wednesday from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. year-round. Stop by and say hi to over 80 vendors who make it, bake it, and grow it in the Dove Building located on the CLE grounds. Sensia Corporate Web Solutions. Log on to sensia.ca for information about locally owned and operated hosting, site creation, and more. The Study Coffee House. The Study is a fully licensed, intimate live venue and the place to get your caffeine fix while on the Lakehead University campus.
CILU now presents Indie Beat.